This episode of Coffee House Shots is sponsored by Alliance Witten Investment Trust. From the OPEC oil crisis of the 1970s, the financial crash in 2008, to the COVID epidemic and Liz Truss's doomed premiership, there has been no shortage of economic crises over the last 58 years. And yet, throughout that time, every single year, without fail, we've paid out an increased dividend to our shareholders. In fact, Alliance Witten's history dates all the way back to 1888. And today, we manage around £5 billion in assets. If you're looking for a less stressful way to invest in stocks and shares, learn more about Alliance Witten and find your comfort zone.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I am joined by our new economics editor, Michael Simmons, and an old Coffee House Shots favourite. That's not me saying you're old, by the way, just that you've long loved, Stephen Bush from the Financial Times. Thank you both. Michael, just to kick things off, we have had the much awaited announcement today from Liz Kendall in the Commons Chamber of the government's plans for welfare reform. Talk us through the main announcements and how they corresponded to what was briefed in advance.
Yeah, so there's a mix of things and it's sort of come carrot and stick. And if we start with the carrot, some of the changes are that UC is going to be put up above inflation. So that's going to mean that UC payments are going to go up by about £775 sort of per claimant. Also, people who suffer from the kind of worst, most debilitating illnesses are not going to be subject to continual reassessments. They're just going to be assessed once and effectively left alone on the benefit. And that's something that disability campaigners have been calling for and sort of wasn't announced. On the other side, PIP is going to be tightened up. So you're going to need a higher score. PIP works on, you know, various scoring depending on your disability to get different elements of it and to get different aspects of the payment. So that's going to be made harder to get on. The real big change is this work capability assessment, which we've spoke about on the podcast before, which basically puts people on UC and other benefits into categories. You're either fit to work or you're not fit to work. That's for a long time been seen as a big problem because once you get into the not fit for work category, most people just stay in it. That's going to be scrapped, and then they will just use PIP to decide if people shouldn't have to work because they already have these health conditions. But what sort of wasn't trailed about that, although that reform will be welcomed by people who, you know, have been critics of the system, it's not going to come in until 2028. And, you know, the forecasts we've got on the Spectator's Data Hub from the DWP show, you know, thousands and thousands more people falling into this category in that time. The real announcement that no one had trailed, I think, is they're going to make it harder for young people to get on these benefits. Right now, there's something like 266,000 young people who are out of work due to long-term sickness. So the minimum age before you can claim PIP is going to increase. And then, crucially, the age in which you can get the health elements of UC is going to be set to 22 and above. And the idea is to stop people, as soon as they finish school or college or whatever, from going straight into a life of being too sick to work. It's going to try to encourage people into getting into work in the first place.
Stephen, talk us through the politics of all this.
Right, so the politics of this are essentially, there are a bunch of measures that, broadly speaking, people in the Labour Party, disability rights campaigners, and critics of the current system have all been calling for a long time. Broadly speaking, to end this very unhelpful binary, because the other aspect of this unhelpful binary is, let's say you have a post-viral condition, which means that you can't work for a year, and then after a year you think, oh, do you know what? I want to see if I can do 6 hours a week. The previous system essentially meant that if you then did 6 hours, you then A, lost all of your benefit, and your benefit for seeking work is about half of being unable to work. So that's a huge financial disincentive. But also, of course, lots of people who think they are well ready to go to work. I mean, we all experience that occasion when we have a cold, right? You go like, oh, I think I am capable of going back into the office today. And then you realise at the end of the day that you have absorbed absolutely nothing in a kind of feverish. So getting rid of those very binary, very hard stops, increasing the generosity of UC, which is the benefit for everyone who's in some form, also fixes that cliff edge. So that's the stuff that Labour MPs will like. Then you have a bunch of, like, these points changes, which are to be honest, very hard to defend intellectually, right? Just like it's not obvious why whether or not you can wash your upper or your lower half of your body, for example, should give you a higher or lower point score between the two. It's just one of those things where I don't think for a moment that a minister could on television explain why it is that if you can't wash your knees, you have less need than if you can't wash your elbows. That stuff is the kind of thing which will make Labour activists very angry, Labour MPs very unhappy, and will be the kind of thing that people will struggle to defend. The third part of the politics, of course, is that although the Labour Party has wanted to reform the functioning of universal credit from coming into office, it was in their manifesto, et cetera, et cetera. The added dimension is that because of the deterioration of the British economy, Rachel Reeves' headroom against her fiscal rules has vanished. So they are incentivized to do things that not only they think will save money, but then the OBR thinks will save money. And of course, although we're better off having a watchdog than we were in the pre-2010 situation where the Chancellor of the day could go, oh, this is a bit tricky, I'll just fiddle my growth figures to get myself out of a hole. The OBR has consistently believed that things will reduce welfare spending. And just haven't, right? Yeah, they've gone like, oh yeah, that will create, yeah. The reason why we have this weird situation where we spend about as much as a share of GDP as we did in 2007, but we have more destitution and basically a less effective system overall, is because of attempts to have these savings savings that haven't materialised. And the political challenge is if you are the government, you are, you know, can you with a straight face defend the social misery caused by some of the spending cuts, the effectiveness of, you know, in some ways the proposed spending cuts move the problem that the spending increases are meant to fix. And it will, of course, put further pressure on the other bits of government spending that the government is doing less of. So, for example, what is the alternative if you are a young person? It's to be in employment or training. What has this government consciously done? It's increased the cost of employing young people by equalising the minimum wage. It's cut further education to meet pressures in the education budget. And so you suddenly go like, okay, so what's your proposed thing that you'd like a school leaver to do? I don't know, and also it's not bailing out universities, right? So the politics of, okay, how you justify some of these spending cuts are going to be quite tricky for the Labour Party.
And Michael, a row that is immediately brewing, though I think it's fair to say at the time of recording, so far it's the usual suspects really going public with criticism of the measures so far. You've had Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell, but there is some unhappiness about the lack of assessment.
Yeah, so the government says that they're aiming to save $5 billion from these reforms, from these cuts, from tightening up PIP and other things. But with the Green Paper and, you know, various bits of analysis that the DWP have published after the speech, there's nothing that actually, you know, says how they've come to that figure. And the answer comes back that, oh, just wait for the OBR to score it, who are going to give their final assessment and forecast of the economy this Friday before the spring statement next week. But I think that's unusual, because when we've had changes like this in the past, there's usually, you know, there usually is some basis given for the cost savings. So I think that's maybe a slight red flag that when we see the spring statement and the EFO, which is the document the OBR produce whenever there's a budget or a spring statement or whatever, that we might actually not see the trailed costing. So that certainly caused a bit of chatter first off.
Stephen, when it comes to, I suppose, where this goes next, I mean, we know that welfare is probably the issue as a whole that is going to be the most divisive or likely to, you know, spark a Labour rebellion or unhappiness. Obviously, the two-child benefit cap policy was the one with the largest rebellion to date. Do you get a sense there will be a big rebellion here, or do you think there's been enough work going on behind the scenes? And if it's not perhaps a huge rebellion, do you think there is still some political problems coming up the track as this policy, you know, starts to be rolled out, charity groups, others come out?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, so one of the important things that didn't happen is because they aren't freezing the rate, there doesn't have to be a formal vote on that, which means there is less likely to be a big flashpoint in terms of the Commons vote. And partly because the Conservative opposition is backing that, it then becomes even harder for the government whips to go, oh, you've got to do us a solid, because ultimately it's going to pass anyway, right? That moment of reckoning has been moved. But in terms of the social cost of some of these changes, they, of course, will just become a kind of day-to-day thing of people writing to their MP and going, either I, or actually looking at some of the eligibility cliffs, it will be, you know, the person I care for, or, you know, my great aunt or some variant of that has now been, you know, her point score has been reduced. Why? And I do think a big political problem for the government with this, with these changes, is that which things have taken a haircut in terms of what your problems buy you in your points assessment is, I would say, impossible to justify intellectually, right? It very much does feel like someone's gone, this number needs to equal 5 billion at the end of it, and that number, you know, yeah, and changing that PIP score reduces that by, you know, X by Y amount. It's, you know, it's OBR-based policymaking, which I think is going to be increasingly hard to defend. I suspect, and one of the reasons why we didn't get the usual here's why we've justified this, is it would become, I think it will become quite apparent that, yeah, broadly speaking, two people who I think a medical expert or indeed a layperson would look at and go, those two people are equally either capable or incapable, will get quite different final scores at the end of this process. I think it is going to just be a running sore that the reason for it is going to, you know, obviously they're not going to express it, but it will be obvious to the dogs in the street that the reason for that will be, we had to find £5 billion from somewhere, and I'm afraid this person with hearing aids is the one who's lost out as a result.
And Michael, just finally, of course, we have the spring statement next week, and we know that part of the reason they are pushing ahead at the pace they are on welfare reform is a sense that Rachel Reeves's headroom could be gone. How are things looking for the Chancellor?
They're not looking great. They're looking probably even worse than when we, you know, first said that the headroom was gone at the start of the year because of increased borrowing costs in the gilt markets. Although those have recovered slightly, she's had worse news in that in January, the economy contracted. Just yesterday, the OECD have downgraded forecasts for Britain's growth. It's inevitable that the OBR will make a similar assessment, and those growth figures going down would further dent what you have there in the headroom. And I think it's interesting what Stephen said about OBR policymaking, or OBR sort of driven policymaking, because one of her ironclad rules is this one about getting debt as a share of income falling at the end of the forecast period. And I think that's partly why some of these measures don't come in for a few years, because it effectively gives them the room to say, right, this is going to happen in a few years to the OBR, costs are going to come down, that can have an impact on the national debt, but then you've actually got time before then to change the measure, or dare I say it, not do the measure at all.
Yeah, because a neglected political subplot is that Rachel Reeves has her Council of Economic Advisers, one of whom is a very respected economist who many people expect will win a Nobel at some point, this guy called John Van Reenen, and one of the reasons why he's there is, A, to help with the growth agenda, but also effectively to be the person who convinces people who work at the OBR that the things that the government thinks will change the UK's growth and the state of the public finances will have that effect, right? Because ultimately, with any labour market intervention, so, you know, where economic liberals like me look at what they're doing on the labour market and go, OK, yeah, you might move money around by doing this, but you're not going to increase the growth rate. Obviously, if someone from the Labour government were here, they'll go, no, that we will all do better because of these changes. And the OBR then has to take a view, and that's what creates your headroom, or in this creates your lack of headroom. The government believes that the changes it's making to welfare will reduce the welfare bill. And then it has a bunch of changes which the OBR believes will reduce the OBR. Michael's exactly right. Then what they will hope will happen is in 2027 they will either have been validated, or they will at least have convinced the OBR that they've been validated. And then, like these other changes, they can go, oh, well, we don't need to do those anymore because the out-of-work benefits bill will fall. I mean, for example, none of us know how effective Wes Streeting's plans to reform the NHS will actually be. If it turns out that the fall in waiting list continues, you would assume that that will naturally reduce the number of people claiming on sickness benefit, because people will have their NHS procedures.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Michael. And thank you for listening.